6. The Rise of Toussaint. The relation of forces in San Domingo was now completely changed, and although few recognized it fully at the time, Toussaint and the blacks were henceforth the decisive factors in the revolution. Toussaint was now a French officer in command of an army of some 5,000 men, holding a line of camps or fortified positions between the North Province and the West, and had pushed his way into the West Province as far as the right bank of the Artibonite. Rigaud, in the south, had taken the lead over Beauvais and was occupied with his own campaign against the British. The Republic, weak on the sea, could send no assistance. Both British and Spaniards, thanks to the British fleet and British wealth, were well supplied with money and arms. The British were in possession of some of the most fertile districts in the colony, and the formerly rich North Plain, though now held again by the French, was practically devastated. The owners of property betrayed the Republic at every turn. All that the Republic had to offer was liberty and equality, but they were enough. For years, Pitt and Dundas continued to pour men and money into the West Indies against what they were pleased to call brigands. Helped by the climate, the black laborers, so recently slaves, and the loyal mulattoes, led by their own officers, inflicted on Britain the severest defeat that has befallen a British expeditionary force between the days of Elizabeth and the Great War. The full story remained hidden for over a century until it was unearthed in 1906 by Fortescue, the historian of the British Army. He puts the blame on Pitt and Dundas, who had full warning that on this occasion they would have to fight not only poor, sickly Frenchmen, but the Negro population of the West Indies. Yet they poured their troops into these pestilent islands in the expectation that thereby they would destroy the power of France, only to discover, when it was too late, that they had practically destroyed the British army. Laveau was now in sole charge of the colony, Sontenax and Polverel having been recalled, accused of treason and all other crimes by some of the émigré colonists. These had abandoned the monarchy, embraced the Jacobins, and managed to achieve this much before the decree of February 4th. But though Toussaint dutifully informed his chief of every step, he was practically in unchecked command of the bulk of the forces and of his district. Everything depended on the army. The majority of Toussaint's rank and file were Africans born out of the colony, unable to speak two words of French, in Jean-Francois' scornful phrase. The chief officers also were, like Toussaint himself, ex-slaves. Besides Dessalines, there was Christophe, who had left the hotel to seek Toussaint's band in the mountains, his brother, Paul Louverture, and Moïse, who had crossed the Atlantic as a child and was adopted by Toussaint, passing as his nephew. The army, except for a few white officers, was a revolutionary army through and through, and that was its greatest strength. If the Republic, liberty, and equality gave the army its morale, its center was Toussaint himself. He had had his first command in October 1792, and in less than 2 years, we find him writing more than once that a long experience has taught him the necessity of being himself on the spot. Otherwise, things never go well. His presence had that electrifying effect characteristic of great men of action. "I put before them the position of the enemy and the absolute necessity of driving him off. The brave Republicans, Moïse, J.B. Paparé, Dessalines, and Noël, answered in the name of all the chiefs that they would brave any sort of danger, that they would go anywhere, and that they would follow me to the end." The ranks, although exhausted, responded in the same way and marched against musket and cannon shot without drawing a single weapon, guns and bandoliers. "Nothing," said Toussaint, "could resist the valor of the sans-culottes." On one occasion when ammunition had given out, they fought with stones. He lived with the men and charged at their head. If cannon was to be moved, he himself helped, once getting a hand badly crushed in the process. All knew him from the few months before when he was merely old Toussaint. he shared all their toils and dangers. But he was self-contained, impenetrable, and stern, with the habit and manner of the born aristocrat. "I have received your letter as well as the minutes of your meeting," he writes to some of his officers. "I have noted with pleasure the manner in which you have repulsed the enemy, and I have only praise for the way in which you have exterminated him with a courage worthy of good Republicans. But I see, citizens, with much pain, that the orders which I have given you three times running to move on to the territory of our enemies and drive them from it have not been put into execution. If you had condescended to execute the orders which I had sent to you, all the camps on the other side of the Artibonite would have been destroyed. You have trampled my orders into the dust." His extraordinary abilities, his silence, the sharpness of his tongue when he spoke, kept even his most trusted officers at a distance. They worshipped him, but feared rather than loved him. Even Dessalines, the tiger, was afraid of Toussaint. And this excessive reserve and aloofness, though they grew on him and would one day have their full consequences, were of inestimable value in those early, undisciplined days. The troops often were without even food and had to go looking for sugarcane. Even when some arms did arrive in August, they were no good. "I have received 2,000 guns, but they are in bad condition. I shall get them repaired. Many are too short, and these I shall give to the dragoons. Many of the guns in the 7th and 8th regiments are no good." The British and Spaniards, having all they wanted and knowing the condition of Toussaint's men, sent agents among them offering them arms and accoutrements and good pay. From Lavaux to the laborers, the British made their offers of money. But there is no record of any notable success with Toussaint's men. The morale of the Revolutionary Army was too high. Toussaint had the advantage of liberty and equality, the slogans of the revolution. They were great weapons in an age of slaves, but weapons must be used, and he used them with a fencer's finesse and skill. Bands of Maroons infested the war area, the most powerful a band of 5,000 under Dieudonné. Rigaud and Beauvais were trying to get him to cooperate with them, but Dieudonné distrusted them, said he did not want to obey any mulatto, and entered into negotiations with the British. The British had made all arrangements to buy him over, but the millstone around their necks in this campaign was their reactionary policy. They could not even lie on a large scale. It was too dangerous, and their rich allies would have deserted them at once. They had to be so careful even about making arrangements with Dieudonné that he got suspicious and withdrew. Beauvais and Rigaud heard about Dieudonné's negotiations with the British and begged Toussaint to use his influence. With a single one of his dictated letters, Toussaint changed the whole situation. "I cannot believe the painful rumors that are spread about you, that you have abandoned your country to ally yourself with the English, sworn enemies of our liberty and equality. Can it be possible, my dear friend, that at the very moment when France triumphs over all the royalists and recognizes us for her children by her beneficent decree of the 9 Thermidor, accords us all our rights for which we are fighting, that you should let yourself be deceived by our ancient tyrants who are only using one half of our unhappy brothers in order to load the other with chains? For a time, the Spaniards had blinded my eyes, but I did not take long to recognize their rascality. I abandoned them and have beaten them well. I returned to my country, which received me with open arms and has recompensed my services well. I beg of you, my dear brother, to follow my example. If special reasons prevent you from having confidence in Generals Rigaud and Beauvais, Governor Lavaux, who is a good father to all of us and in whom our mother country has placed its confidence, should at least deserve yours. I hope that you will not refuse me, who am a black as yourself, and I assure you, wish nothing more than to see you happy, you and all our brothers. As far as I am concerned, I believe that our only hope of this is in serving the French Republic. It is under its flag that we are truly free and equal. That is how I see it, my dear friend. And I do not believe that I am making a mistake. The letter is worth an immediate second reading. Every sentence hits home. If it is possible that the English have succeeded in deceiving you, believe me, my dear brother, abandon them. Unite yourself to honest Republicans, and all together let us chase these royalists from our country. They are rascals who wish to burden us again with those shameful chains that we have had so much trouble to break. He begged for unity. Remember, my dear friend, that the French Republic is one and indivisible, and it is that which gives it its strength and has made it victorious over all its enemies. Time would show to what degree Toussaint was sincere in these constant references to the French Republic. His envoys took this letter to Dudonnet's camp and read it to the assembled troops. When the blacks heard it, they burst out into invectives against Dudonnet and his friends, conclusive proof that though they were ignorant and unable to pick their way among the mass of proclamations, lies, promises, and traps which surrounded them, yet they wanted to fight for liberty. La Plume, Dudonnet's second in command, profiting by this disillusionment, arrested Dudonnet and two of his followers on the spot. This also was the work of Toussaint, who had instructed his men that if Dudonnet was completely won over by the British, they were to take some of the other chiefs aside and, with the utmost energy, show them that they were being deceived. Dudonnet was thrown into prison, but La Plume, instead of joining Rigaud or Beauvais, joined Toussaint's forces with 3,000 men. Toussaint wrote hastily to Lavaux, begging him to make La Plume a colonel. I assure you that this will produce the best effect. And Lavaux sanctioned the appointment. Rigaud and Beauvais could hardly have been too pleased. A force of 3,000 men was an immense acquisition, and Toussaint had won them by a letter and a deputation. If the army was the instrument of Toussaint's power, the masses were its foundation, and his power grew with his influence over them. Just out of the degradation of slavery, they had come into a world of indiscriminate murder and violence. The Spaniards invited 800 French back from the United States to Port-au-Prince. After a church sermon, the priest, Vasquez, gave the signal to Jean-Francois, who had spent the morning with him in the confessional box. The Spanish soldiers joined with Jean-Francois's bands and quietly murdered over 1,000 French people, men, women, and children. They at least would never claim their property again. Such were the models of civilization for the ex-slaves. Great tracts of the West Province were continually being fought over, devastated, and burnt. In the war areas, rich and poor, black and white, all starved. Little wonder that the black laborers were constantly in a state of insurrection. Fear of the restoration of slavery was always the cause of the trouble. The British had no intention of abolishing slavery. Neither had the Spaniards. Permission to form black regiments was only given in 1795, and even then it was most positively forbidden that any who served with the British should be promised freedom. But they could not keep that up, and the British got blacks to fight on their side by paying them. All parties confused the ignorant Negroes by playing on their fears and accusing every other party, the French and Toussaint himself, of wishing to restore slavery. The British and Spaniards could second their propaganda with offers of money and guns. Jean-Francois told the blacks that only a king had authority to make them free, and therefore they must fight for the Spanish king. Some planters hid the decree from their slaves. The blacks already distrusted the white planters. Now, the machinations of British and Spaniards were teaching those who were learning to understand politics that nearly all whites in the colonies were the same, birds of prey feeding on the ignorance and inexperience of the great masses of the black laborers. For these blacks, lacking civic discipline, running wild in a country torn by revolution and war, knowing only that they wanted to remain free, yet confused and deceived by all parties. For them, Toussaint had a deep and passionate sympathy. "Oh, you Africans, my brothers," he addresses them in a proclamation. "You who have cost me so many fatigues, so much labor, so much worry, you whose liberty is sealed with more than half of your own blood, how long will I have the mortification of seeing my misled children fly the counsels of a father who idolizes them?" Autocrat though he was, that is the way he felt about his people. "It is always the blacks who suffer the most," was an expression often on his lips, and one can feel his spontaneous horror at the news of a rising provoked by the British among the cultivators of a district in the North Province. "You will not have much difficulty in divining whence has come this terrible blow. Is it then possible that the laborers will always be the playthings and the instruments of vengeance of those monsters whom hell has loosed upon this colony? The blood of so many victims cries for vengeance, and human and divine justice cannot delay to confound the guilty." At the first hint of insurrection, he would go himself. The most difficult districts were around Limbe, Plaisance, Marmalade, and Port-de-Paix, the early centers of the revolt in the North Province and destined to hold the first place to the end. Early in 1796, for instance, he hears one day that the laborers of Port-de-Paix have taken arms and massacred some whites. In one night, he covers the long distance from Verrette to Port-de-Paix. He calls the blacks together and gives them an address on the way they should conduct themselves. If they have grievances, assassination is not the way to have them redressed. One of them speaks for the rest. "Alas, General, they want to make us slaves again. There is no equality here as it seems there is in your part of the world. They look at us with a bad eye. They persecute us." Their provisions are taken for less than they were worth. The whites take their chickens and pigs. If they protest, they are thrown into prison. And to get out of prison, they have to pay. "The reasons you have given me seem justified," says Toussaint. "But if even you had a house full of them, you have rendered yourself wrong in the sight of God." They begged him to organize them. "Fix everything. We shall be so good that everybody will be forced to forget what we have just done." Next day, Toussaint calls a meeting of all the blacks in the district. He makes them swear to work hard and be obedient. He appoints a commander. The laborers cried, "Long live the Republic! Long live liberty! Long live equality! Long live Governor Lavaux! Long live Toussaint Louverture!" They danced and cheered Toussaint when he left. Unfortunately, there was another insurrection soon after, and the leader and 12 of his friends were tried by military tribunal and shot the same day. Toussaint went again and discovered that the British had been intriguing among them, had given them guns and ammunition. Toussaint arrested no one, fired no shot, but talked to them and was able to lead them back to work. He wasn't always so successful. "I went myself to speak to them and try to make them see reason. They armed themselves, and I received as thanks for my pains a bullet in my leg from which I still feel some lively pain." But these years, 1795 and 1796, marked the growth of confidence in him by the laborers in the North Province, not only as a soldier, but as a man devoted to their interests, whom they could trust in all the difficulties that surrounded them, the man who was on their side in the struggle against slavery. By his incessant activity on their behalf, he gained their confidence. And among a people ignorant, starving, badgered, and nervous, Toussaint's word, by 1796, was law. The only person in the North whom they could be depended upon to obey. But despite the ignorance and confusion, there was a new spirit abroad. Black San Domingo had changed and would never be the same again. whether fighting with English, Spanish, or French. Even Jean-François, royalist, dismissed Laveau's overtures with incisive scorn. "Until I see Monsieur Laveau and other French gentlemen of his quality giving their daughters in marriage to Negroes, only then will I believe in all your pretended equality." All the French blacks, from the laborers at Port de Paix demanding equality, to the officers in the army, were filled with an immense pride at being citizens of the French Republic, one and indivisible, which had brought liberty and equality into the world. Officers of different colors would not accept invitations offered to one group. As good Republicans, they refused to bow and scrape before the Spanish Marquis, who raged at the impertinence of these blacks. 5 years of revolution had wrought these astonishing changes. Toussaint always addressed the blacks as French citizens. "What will France think if she learns that your conduct was not worthy of true Republicans?" Devotion to the Republic and a hatred of royalty and all that it stood for fills the documents of the time. Jean-François had issued a proclamation, "In the name of the king, his master," offering his brothers in Dondon provisions, arms, all that they needed from the moment they joined the Spanish side. The municipality of Dondon made a withering reply. "Some Republicans have offered to surrender? If there were among us men low enough to resume their chains, we abandon them to you with a good heart. The liberty that the Republicans offer us, you say, is false. We are Republicans, and, in consequence, free by natural right. It can only be kings whose very name expresses what is most vile and low, who dare to arrogate the right of reducing to slavery men made like themselves, whom nature had made free. The King of Spain furnished you abundantly with arms and ammunition. Use them to tighten your chains. As for us, we have need for no more than stones and sticks to make you dance the Carmagnol. You have received commissions, and you have guarantees. Guard your liveries and your parchments. One day they will serve you as the fastidious titles of our former aristocrats served them. If the king of the French, who drags his misery from court to court, has need of slaves to assist him in his magnificence, let him go seek it among other kings who count as many slaves as they have subjects. You conclude, vile slaves as you are, by offering us the protection of the king, your master. Learn and say to Casa Calvo, the Spanish Marquis, that Republicans cannot treat with a king. Let him come, and you with him. We are ready to receive you as Republicans should." That was the style, the accent of Toussaint and his men. The British and the Spaniards could not defeat it. All they could offer was money. And there are periods in human history when money is not enough. A growing army and the confidence of free black laborers meant power. But Toussaint saw early that political power is only a means to an end. The salvation of San Domingo lay in the restoration of agriculture. This was an almost insuperable task in a disorganized society, depending on the labor of men just out of slavery and surrounded on every side by the rabid greed and violence of French, Spaniards, and British. Toussaint addressed himself to this from the first days of his command. "Work is necessary," he proclaimed. "It is a virtue. It is for the general good of the state." His regulations were harsh. The laborers were sent to work 24 hours after he assumed control of any district, and he authorized the military commandants of the parishes to take measures necessary for keeping them on the plantations. "The Republic," he wrote, "has no use for dull or incapable men. It was forced labor and restraint of movement. But the need brooked no barriers. He retained the confidence of the laborers because he insisted that wages should be paid, and was equally stern with the white proprietors. All, whether proprietors or others, were ordered to their respective parishes and plantations. If the proprietors did not obey, their property would be confiscated. From the very beginning of his career as administrator, Toussaint had his policy toward the whites clear in his mind, and he never shifted from it. He knew these owners of property, French today, British tomorrow, royalists, Republicans, utterly without principles except insofar as these helped to preserve their plantations. But they had the knowledge, education, and experience which the colony needed if it was to be restored to prosperity. They had traveled in France and in America. They had culture, which only a section of the mulattoes had, and none of the slaves. Toussaint therefore treated them with the utmost forbearance, being helped by an unwarped character which abhorred the spirit of revenge and useless bloodshed of any kind. "No reprisals, no reprisals," was his constant adjuration to his officers after every campaign. It was their plantations these whites wanted, and he gave them their plantations, always ready to forget their treachery if they would work the land. Once, on taking Mirebalais from the British, he found there more than 300 white émigrés from the North Province. It would have been the simplest thing to have these traitors to their country and upholders of slavery shot out of hand. They would certainly not have spared him. He called them before him and made them take the oath of fidelity to the Republic. Some who wanted to return to their parishes asked him for passports, and he obliged them. Their plantations had, of course, been sequestrated. Toussaint made investigations and inquiries, seeking to get them restored. He appointed whites to government posts with the confidence of the old royalist governors. "I have made Guy military commandant and Dubuisson his adjutant. These are two brave Frenchmen who have contributed very much to converting their fellow citizens. I have confided the administration to Jules Borde, who I believe is a good Republican and who possesses the necessary ability to carry out this duty. He has the goodwill of his fellow citizens who approve of my choice." He recommends another white Creole who accompanied him in an expedition and has conducted himself honorably. "I feel fairly certain of his civism." What these whites, with their memories of the past, thought at being looked over, examined, and granted posts with such assurance by a former slave is not known. But there is no record of any disrespect or open hostility. They may have hated it in private, but it would have been difficult to get any response. Toussaint had his army of ex-slaves with its ex-slave officers, which he kept intact and free of possible disruptive elements. But he was so genuinely kind to the whites in their distressful condition that they could not fail to appreciate it. "My heart," he writes to Lavaux at the news of an insurrection, "my heart is torn at the fate which has befallen some unhappy whites who have been victims in this business." That was the way he felt about all people, blacks and whites. The whites grew to recognize that he could always be depended upon to protect them from the laborers ready to massacre them at the slightest hint of any return to slavery. As they learned to trust him, many of them came back to their plantations. White women told Lavaux the attentions and the assistance that they had received from this astonishing man, called the old ex-slave, with his despised black skin, their father. In Lavaux's own words, the parish of Petite Rivière, where he visited Toussaint, offered the satisfying spectacle of more than 15,000 laborers back to work, all full of gratitude to the Republic. Blacks, whites, mulattoes, laborers, proprietors, all blessing the virtuous chief whose care maintained among them order and peace. What must Lavaux have thought, ex-count of the Ancien Régime and a cultivated Frenchman of a cultivated age, as he received week after week these letters from Toussaint, the ex-slave? Very wonderful letters, some of them are. Toussaint was equally master of a proclamation, a delicate piece of maneuvering as his epistle to Dieudonné, or a military dispatch. "The enemy had not taken the precaution to establish on the Saint-Marc Road reserve camps to protect his retreat. I used a trick to encourage him to pass by the highway. This is how. From the town of Verrette, he could see all my movements. So I made my army defile on the side of Mirabelais, where he could see it, so as to give him the idea that I was sending large reinforcements there, while a moment after, I made it re-enter the town of Petite Rivière behind a hill without his perceiving it. He fell right into the snare, seeming even to hasten his retreat. I then made a large body of cavalry cross the river, putting myself at the head of it in order to reach the enemy quickly and keep him busy, and in order to give time to my infantry, which was coming up behind with a piece of cannon to join me. This maneuver succeeded marvelously. I had taken the precaution to send a 4-inch piece of cannon from Petite Rivière to the Moreau plantation at Détroit in order to batter the enemy on the right flank during his passage. While I harassed him with my cavalry, my infantry advanced at great speed with the piece of cannon. As soon as it reached me, I made two columns pass to right and to left to take the enemy in the flank. As soon as these two columns arrived within pistol shot, I served the enemy in true Republican fashion. He continued his way, showing all the time a brave front, but the first cannon shot that I caused to be fired among his men, and which did a great deal of damage, made him abandon first a wagon and then a piece of cannon. I redoubled the charge, and afterwards I captured the other three pieces of cannon, two wagons full of munitions, and seven others full of wounded, who were promptly sent to the rear. Then it was that the enemy began to fly in the greatest disorder, only for those at the head of the retreat to find themselves right in the mouth of the piece of cannon which I had posted at Détroit on the Moreau plantation. And when the enemy saw himself taken in front, behind, and on all sides, that fine fellow, the impertinent Desources, jumped off his horse and threw himself into the brushwood with the debris of his army, calling out, "Every man for himself!" Rain and darkness caused me to discontinue the pursuit. This battle lasted from 11 in the morning to 6 in the evening, and cost me only 6 dead and as many wounded. I have strewn the road with corpses for the distance of more than a league. My victory has been most complete, and if the celebrated Desources is lucky enough to re-enter Saint-Marc, it will be without cannon, without baggage, in short, what is called with neither drum nor trumpet. He has lost everything, even honor, if vile royalists are capable of having any. He will remember for a long time the Republican lesson which I have taught him. I have pleasure in transmitting to you, General, the praises which are due to Dessalines. The battalion of the Sans-Culottes, above all, which saw fire for the second time, showed the greatest courage. Here is not only the born soldier, but the born writer. The despatch has the authentic ring of the great captains. Desources' corps was a famous corps of white Creoles, and the news of this victory of the black sans-culottes over the old planters spread over the colony, lifting the prestige of the blacks and concentrating attention on Toussaint. In administration, as in war, it was the same. Lavaux, from the beginning, seems to have allowed Toussaint carte blanche, and Toussaint made himself into a whole cabinet, like a fascist dictator, except that he actually did the work. The British had made a breach in the Artibonite River in order to flood the lower part of the plain and prevent his soldiers from advancing further. The rains had so widened this breach that it was at least 200 feet wide. He is blocking it with roots, wood, and rocks. He has had more than 800 men working at it for 8 days already, and he will keep them at it until they are finished, because if he leaves it in this state, when the rainy season comes, the country would be devastated by the overflowing of the river and cultivation ruined. "It seems to me," he warns Lavaux, "that you should send some boats with cannon to cruise before Caracol, Limonada, etc., so as to prevent neutral vessels landing in any of these ports. It is to our interest to intercept the provisions and the help that they can receive by sea. Spain and France made peace at the Treaty of Bâle in September 1795. Toussaint warns Laveau not to think that the Spaniards will observe neutrality. He knows them well. They hate liberty for the blacks. They will certainly continue to keep contact with the British, and Laveau should continue to guard the communications. He moves the town of Verrette. It is in a bad position for defense, being dominated by neighboring ground. He traces the plan of a new town in the middle of a superb level savanna, absolutely open. War, politics, agriculture, international relations, long-range problems of administration, minor details, he dealt with them as they came, took decisions and gave advice to Laveau, but, characteristic of his tact, always as a subordinate. When Laveau, neglecting to take his warning of Spanish treachery, reaped his reward, Toussaint gave him a gentle, "I told you so." Even after decisions that he must have known were irrevocable, he submits them as subject to Laveau's approval. In no letter does he find it necessary to explain any charge or complaint made against him by Laveau, yet he writes, "I shall always receive with pleasure the reprimands that you address to me. When I deserve them, it will be a proof of the friendship that you have for me." A strong personal friendship grew up between the two men, so diverse in origin, brought together by the revolution. Laveau was kind-hearted, upright, and devoted to Negro emancipation. Toussaint, infinitely suspicious and very reserved, had absolute faith in Laveau and never trusted any other man, black, white, or brown. Laveau had the same feelings towards him, and a letter of Laveau to Toussaint that remains is addressed to his most intimate friend, Toussaint. Amidst all the military, political, and other problems, there is this note of strong mutual attachment. "Here is something important. I send you some truffle. Be so kind as to accept them from him who wishes you the best of health and who embraces you with all his heart. All my officers assure you of their respect and fidelity. P.S. General, our impatience to see you grows every day. Shall we be long deprived of this pleasure?" 7 days afterwards, it seems that the visit will take place. "I see with pleasure that you will not delay to come to see us here. I await you with the utmost impatience, as do all my men, who ardently desire to see you and, at the same time, to demonstrate to you their attachment." Laveau, it is obvious from Toussaint's replies, wrote in a similar strain. Toussaint gracefully acknowledged his commander's graciousness. "I do not know how to express my thanks for all the pleasant things that you have said to me, and how happy I am to have so good a father who loves me as much as you do. Be sure that your son is your sincere friend, that he will support you until death. My army thanks you for your kind regards and charges me to assure you of its attachment and its submission. I embrace you with all my heart, and be sure that I share with you your difficulties and your cares." Yellow fever killed off the English troops in thousands, but reinforcements always came, and money poured in to finance bodies of French slave owners, white and mulatto, and black troops. At times, internal intrigues and British money made Toussaint's position very weak. But liberty and equality triumphed as Danton had known they would triumph. Toussaint and Rigaud held the English in check. Victor Hugues beat them in engagement after engagement. 1795, says Fortescue, is the most disgraceful year in the history of the British Army. It was the decree of February 4th which had done it. Toussaint, careful of everything, sent a personal deputation to the Republic in France to attest his loyalty and inform them of the care with which he was performing his duties as soldier and protector of cultivation, also, no doubt, to explore French politics. Nothing escaped him. He had joined the French and assumed his command in May 1794. By the beginning of 1796, he was proconsul of his district, governing and fighting as if he had done nothing else all his life. Before such ability, energy, and charm, Laveaux capitulated completely. In the early months of 1796, all San Domingo knew that Toussaint Louverture, the black general, stood first in the counsels and affection of the governor.